Okay. Oh, great. So, bonjour tout le monde et bienvenue à cette assemblée générale de la faculté de médecine. Thank you for coming to this town hall. I don't know if you can hear me. I decided not to wrap this thing around my head and demonstrate that I don't know how to use it. We have a few special presentations today, but I'm going to start off with the traditional in memoriam. So, as always, our tradition is to have a moment of silence for faculty members who are no longer with us. So I'd ask, I think I'm going to ask everyone to stand for a moment of silence. Thank you. So our agenda for today's meeting is highlights by me. Colin Clark, whoever he is, I think he's Colin Chalk, will talk about the new MDCM curriculum. Pascal Mongrain will talk about budget planning. And we're lucky to have Christine Dolan and Andrew Mackey, who are going to talk about administration pilot projects, and then an enormously long list of congratulations of various successes in the faculty. So there we go. So I thought I'd start off by sort of saying where we are with the strategic priorities that we've talked about before. So this is not a new slide. It looks new, but it's the same thing that we had before. And I thought I'd just tell you, you're going to hear about where we are with the new undergraduate medical curriculum. In terms of developing an administrative support model for the schools, so far we've made a bit of modest progress. I just came out of a meeting for the accreditation of postgraduate medicine, during which they were very impressed by the fact that we had hired an accreditation officer. So the idea is to eventually have a small group of people who are experts on accreditation that will be shared across the different schools. So that is some progress. And they were pleased to see that we were about to hire someone who's going to be doing assessment as a special area within postgrad. But eventually, again, we hope to have an office of assessment and evaluation. So there's a little bit of progress there. We've started on a process of having an educational strategic plan, which is being spearheaded by Linda Snell and assisted by John Orlovsky, and they're putting together a team to look at having something that I don't think we've had before, an overall educational strategic plan for the faculty. In research, as you know, Philippe Gros is leading a team which is looking at developing a strategic research plan. I'm pleased to say there's been substantial progress in the sense that all the units of the faculty have sent in proposals for what their priorities are. I met with the team, the executive part of the team yesterday. We went over, they have a scheme for putting it all together. I think we're going to end up with a very interesting plan that will help us orient future investments by the faculty in research going forward. We have, as you know, there's been a search on for directors of the Neuro and the Douglas Research Institute. I'm pleased to say that it's old news now, and I'll mention again later, that Dr. Rouleau has been chosen for the Neuro. We're hot on the heels of an excellent candidate for the Douglas Research Institute, and I'm almost ready to announce the Vice Dean of Research position, so there's been progress there. On the clinical side, the Rossi Cancer Network, those who are working in clinical oncology, I hope will agree that there's been some progress. The Rossi Foundation has put up several $1 million that we've used to set up the infrastructure for this network, but we still have some work to do to get the official agreement signed, and we hope to have a wonderful event in the spring to formally announce this as a done deal. But I'm very pleased with the work that's been done in the sense that for the first time we have really effective collaboration in cancer care among all of the three hospitals and the university. in a way that didn't really exist before, and it's been very, very encouraging. Promote development of informatics support in the MON. The MON is the McGill Academic Health Network. I don't think we've had much progress on that so far. That remains a dream. In terms of the RUIS, however, there's a growing engagement of the faculty in the outlying regions and interest between the outlying regions and the McGill Academic Health Network hospitals. I was to the point, I'll talk about it later, that we're starting to become much more engaged in places like Gatineau and Abitibi. And remember, there's also operational priorities. One of them is to develop an effective budgetary process. Pascal is going to talk about that in a minute. Another need is to develop a comprehensive space plan. That is still on the to-do list, but the need to do it is ever more present. I want to take advantage of this assembly for those who are working in the basic science departments and bench science investigators from the hospitals. Some of you may know that there was a delegation that went to the Merck facility, the now closed Merck facility out on the West Island, which we are investigating as a possible location for certain kinds of research space. Yesterday I hired a consultant to help with that, and there will be a call for interest across the faculty to see if people are interested in participating in that as we explore whether this could be at least a short-term help in trying to address space needs. But obviously we have other space needs, especially on the education side for the schools and others, that still need to be resolved. So that's an area that needs improvement. We also hope to develop a business office, and we're working on that, but that was a project of Dimitri Cafenteris, who had a nice baby boy and is no longer, is not with us for a while. So that's a little bit on hold. We've had a lot of new things and new people in the faculty, new people. So I want to make sure I get everyone's name right before I know I'm going to leave somebody out. So we have Joua, who's taken over pathology, Joua Gao. We have Guy Rouleau, who is about to take over in January, the Montreal Neurological Institute and the MNH. We have Len Levine, who's taken over ophthalmology. Morag Park, who will take over the Goodman Cancer Center, which is being ably led right now by Dr. Siegel, but she'll be officially taking over as director in July. And we have Gilles Paradis, who's taken over epidemiology, biostatistics, and occupational health. On the administrative side, we're going to hear from, actually, Pascal Mongrain, who is taken over as running the business operations of the faculty. Andrew, you're going to hear from with Christine. Christine is moved into Amara Ludwig's office in Faculty Affairs, and Andrew is in charge of HR. We have Joanne Liebosch, who is the interim director of development for the faculty, succeeding Michelle, and Anna Maria Henderson, who is the associate director for administrative excellence. I'm supposed to tell you about the new class of medical students, which is kind of cool. We have 187 medical students, who are all very smart. It says here. The modal grade of an incoming medical student is 4. That's a modal GPA is 4. More interestingly, 58% of them are of the female gender, which is actually an increase, I think, for our school. We're usually closer to 50-50. And they're very young, and about a third of them are Francophone. I have to say that it's very gratifying to see the kind of students we get here, not only in the medical school, but particularly in the medical school, when we talk about them being Francophone or Anglophone, but actually I suspect about 80% of them are trilingual. But I don't know if that's an accurate number, but they're really an amazing group of people. But other amazing groups of people are in our other schools. So one of the highlights this year was the naming of the Ingram School of Nursing. And there you can see the back of my head as I hope desperately for that thing to fall down and show the flag at the opening. That was actually one of the most exciting and pleasant events that we had in a long time. This is a fantastic initiative from the Mr. Ingram and the Newton Foundation, which has inaugurated the naming of the school, but also a wonderful program and patient collaborative program for education, innovation, and patient and family-centered care, as well as the Susan E. French Chair now held by Sean Clark, who's director of that collaborative program. And really, our school nursing is doing really well. I just had the privilege of meeting the accreditors. It's a big accreditation series season now. The accreditors for the the Direct Entry Master's Program, where people come from another bachelor's program and go into Master's of Nursing, and they were extremely impressed with everything except for our physical plant. Before I get to the Rosa Cancer Network, there's stuff going on, of course, in our other schools. The PNOT has launched a new bilingual online graduate certificate in chronic pain management, and tomorrow we receive Her Excellency, Mrs. Governor General, otherwise known as Sharon Johnson, who, of course, is a graduate of NPT and a PhD. In fact, Jim Martin and I remember her as a PhD student with Dr. Macklem. We met her many, many times in the Meekins. So she's coming here tomorrow to give the Edith Aston McCrimmon Lecture. And so that's going to be an exciting day in PNOT. The Rossi Cancer Network, I think I mentioned this already, that we've gotten to the point of having a preliminary project plan developed and new quality initiatives programs. I have to say it's some of these, there's a number of major initiatives associated with this, but already the most important one led by, I think, Ann Lynch is the one in terms of getting patient satisfaction surveys. That's actually fully implemented, which is pretty good considering we still have to finalize the agreement with the Rossi Foundation. So I think it's a real tribute to the Rossi Foundation and a vote of confidence in our faculty and our hospitals that they've advanced this, the resources, even before we signed on the dotted line. I think this is actually has the potential to be one of the most exciting initiatives on the clinical side we've ever had, because it's really brought together the teaching hospitals. But I also think it's going to create enormous opportunities on the research side once it's well implemented, because there's a great desire by people in the cancer center, for example, to have access to patient samples. But also, I think there'll be opportunities to do evaluative and outcomes research that at a higher level than ever before. So this is, you have to watch this space, as they say. This is really exciting. I got my picture taken once again, this time in Gatineau, where we went, and they were amazed that that we only spoke French. The best part of this is some people will know that in the last provincial election, one of the enjeux was the fact that they wanted to have a medical school in Gatineau. And Gatineau, for those who don't know, is that part of Quebec right across the Ottawa River from Ottawa. You may not know, I certainly didn't know, that it's actually it's 365,000 people in the region. And as far as agencies go or health regions, it's only slightly smaller than Laval. In fact, it may now be bigger than Laval. So it's a very big region. It's part of our RUIS. They're very keen to collaborate with us both in clinical activities, but also professional education and research. In fact, they're incredibly keen on research. The gentleman over here is the president of the University of Quebec in Outaouais, and this is the president of the agence, and they are very keen on collaborating with McGill. The best part of the day was when, because there's a lot of pressure to create a medical school, and when they were asked, we want a faculty of medicine, the gentleman who runs the agence said, well, we have a faculty of medicine, it's McGill. So that was a good part of the day. There's other stuff going on. Let me make sure I get it right. At St. Mary's, St. Mary's finishes accreditation, and got a Building Environmental Standards Award. That's pretty cool. The MUHC, I think the big news, of course, is Guy Rouleau's recruitment that everybody knows about, but also Martine Alfonso, who was the clinical administrator from the Neuro, is now going to be the new Associate Director General of the Children's, which is that'll take place in early January, and that'll be a real boost, I think, for the Children's, which needed some renewal in its administration. Over at the Douglas, the eating disorder, the eating disorders clinic, which is run by our own Mimi Israel and her partner, whose name, of course, I'm forgetting right now. Hopefully, not in the audience. It celebrated its 25th anniversary, and as you know, it's one of the most largest and most successful eating disorder clinics in Canada. And, of course, at the Jewish, anybody who drives by there know that it continues to grow. The K Pavilion is getting closer to being finished, and it keeps out of the newspapers, unlike some other of our teaching hospitals. On that note, I want to say that actually, although you do read about our big teaching hospital in the newspaper, not everything you read in the paper is actually exactly correct. But more importantly, I think I had the privilege of going to several events, but it was really striking when I went to the Director General's Awards event that was held recently, the contrast between what you read in the newspaper, particularly the Gazette, and the people who work in our hospitals and who are so committed and dedicated to providing excellent health care, excellent research, and excellent teaching was striking. So just a note, a little editorial note, not everything that Aaron Durfel says is exactly true. And so are there any questions or comments? If not, thank you for your attention. I want to transfer the microphone to Dr. Colin Chalk, who is going to tell us about part of the new MDCM curriculum, which has implications for the entire faculty. You probably know how to put this on.
These things are actually meant to paraphrase Dylan Thomas for victims of head-shrinking tribes, and I will hold it like you did. Yes, Colin Clark, I get that all the time. So name, please, Chalk, C-H-A-L-K. Oh, Clark. No. Chalk. So whoever said that, don't worry, it's happened before. So what I would like to do is give you a bit of a background overview and where we are with the part of the MDCM curriculum that's going to change the most, which is the first 18 months. It's not the only part that's changing, but it's the one where the changes are going to be the most visible. Those of you who don't know who I am, those are my various day jobs as well. So a little bit of history. If you came to this medical school about 1900, you would have found each basic science subject taught more or less in isolation as a sort of self-contained course. And this state of affairs continued throughout most of the 20th century. When I was a student, it was certainly still going on. In 1994, a new curriculum, which is the current curriculum, was introduced, in which the somewhat radical idea of systematizing the teaching of medical information was introduced, so that instead of teaching courses, we began to teach organ-based systems. And the hope was this would unify somewhat disconnected teaching of anatomy, physiology, and so forth. And so that led to the unit structure, which forms the basis of medicine, which is the first 18 months of our current curriculum. In 2005, from various elements within the faculty, the physicianship program was introduced, and this was meant to we highlight the idea of the physician as professional and healer, and so this was established and grew alongside the basis of medicine. In 2010, the previous dean initiated a faculty strategic planning exercise, one of whose mandates was to look at education, and something called the Education Design Group produced a report. Its authors are listed there. At least two of them are in the room, and I'm not sure if Joyce is here or not. This report came out of consultation with a large number of people within the faculty as well as several external experts. And the mandate really was to look at what we're doing now, what we're doing well, and what we're not doing well. And a number of problems were identified. It's easy to ask oneself, well, it's not broken, so why should we fix it? But in fact, it was seen that there are some problems. And so what are they? This is summarizing a longer report, which you can read at your leisure. But it was thought that the current curriculum is, in some respects, failing to meet societal needs, in that we are presumably meant to be producing, amongst other things, family medicine physicians, which we have historically not done very well. And our graduates perform poorly on a number of aspects of the knowledge base of medicine, which are related to larger societal issues and have never done well on that. Defining the limits of what we actually teach is an exercise that's never really been done in the faculty. Essentially, the question is, what does every graduate of this faculty need to know? And that's not an easy question. We would like to think that we're promoting scholarship and critical thinking, but if you actually get down to brass tacks and say, so show me that that is so, it's not so easy. There is an accreditation issue looming, and this was a year or two ago, I think, quite a serious threat. I think it's a little bit less serious now, but it's still there. The specific issues that the accreditation bodies were concerned about are what I've indicated there. And then, although not specifically stated by the design group, all of us involved in the teaching of BOM and physicianship have been aware for some time, I think, about the disconnect between BOM and physicianship. And this is to both parties' detriment. So the feeling was from the design group that one should try to fix some of these problems, and instead of just tinkering here and there, we should really start again. Time for a new curriculum. So in other words, time to build a better bomb. And so we have moved forward with this. The new bomb, which I'm going to tell you about, is going to be called Fundamentals of Medicine and Dentistry. And this process has been in process. This process has started late 2010, early 2011, and I was asked to take this on. And I've accumulated a number of companions on the journey. It's a little bit like the Lord of the Rings, actually. I realize I'm sort of Frodo, and now I'm pushing out into the boat at the end of the first movie, I think. But anyways, the other members of the Fellowship of the Ring are listed here. And they're selected largely to represent what I think are the major elements that need to be represented. They're also represented because they're people I get along with, and so if you're on a boat with somebody, you want to make sure you get along with them. So they can be given credit for any of the good things, and I'll take all the blame. All right, so back to the problem. So I'm not going to tell you about how we're proposing to deal with all these problems. I'm going to select some of them that are particularly important. And let me begin with the family medicine issue. And what I'll actually do here is just simply lift a paragraph from the design group's report and give you a minute to read it, because I think it states the issue as well as I can state. So the real issue is the sentence in italics at the end of this paragraph, and how can one promote the practice of family medicine, the choice of family medicine as a career in a class like ours, where historically this has not been the thing that people have done. And there is experience from elsewhere about how this can be done. So depending on who you talk to, family medicine has got either a low profile, a no profile, or a negative profile in the faculty. And certainly the data show that for many, many years, a relatively small proportion of our graduates choose family medicine. This is different than other large universities, different than other universities in Quebec, different than other research-intensive universities and so forth. And I think that it's hard to argue with the idea that we are a publicly funded institution. We presumably have some kind of obligation to those who pay our bills, and we are in some respect not meeting those obligations. So how can we move forward with this? So raising the profile of family medicine, a number of things could be done, certainly involving family physicians more in the teaching of students, particularly early on in the curriculum. But more importantly than that is to actually provide students with real-life, regular exposure to family medicine and family medicine practitioners from the beginning of their time in medical school. And so what we're proposing to do is something that's now being called the Longitudinal Family Medicine Program. And the colleague who I don't think is in the room who's really spearheading this is Lenny Lala, who many of you will know, who is one of the many excellent people I have come to know in this process. And what essentially our practical considerations are, in order to make a longitudinal family medicine program worthwhile, we think it needs to be regular, weekly or biweekly. It should start in first year. It should be explicitly connected to what students are doing in the classroom at the same time. And it should be evaluated. If you don't evaluate it, nobody takes it seriously. So we're not proposing to send students out to family doctors' offices to read the magazines in the waiting room. Now, how do you actually do this for a class of 200? And this becomes a very difficult scheduling problem. And we thought that the only really realistic way to do this was to say, okay, we're going to take the class, we'll divide it into quintiles, and every afternoon, one quintile will be off in its family medicine placement somewhere in the city. The corollary of this is if you want to teach the whole class, you're only going to have them in the morning. Anything that happens in the afternoon that isn't family medicine will have to happen at least twice so everybody in the class gets it. And that sounds simple on paper. Less simple as you actually try and write it down with a calendar in hand, and I'm looking forward to the actual doing of it, but I think it is possible. But the immediate important corollary of this is that we tend to think of lecture teaching, which we still heavily depend on, as something that one does for the whole class. So there is a lot less time available in this proposal for lectures than our current 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. And I'll come back to that. So here, I'm not sure where this projects. This is an actual week, what we're proposing to do, the week of the 25th of November, 2013, during the block on circulation. And I show this to just show you the implications of my schedule here. So in the afternoon, we've got quintile A on Monday in their longitudinal family medicine program, quintile B on Tuesday doing the same thing, and so forth. Now, the rest of the class on Monday afternoon is not down at Second Cup checking their email. We're going to make them work as well. But what we have to do is, it so happens on this Monday afternoon, quintiles B, D, and E will have a small group related to epidemiology statistics for clinicians. But in order to make sure the whole class gets these small groups, we have to repeat it again the next day. So in the course of two afternoons, we get the whole class. And so you can sort of see this will repeat itself again and again throughout the year. This is a lot of arranging pieces of puzzles, but it's doable. Now, is that going to solve the problem of family medicine? Clearly, that's not the only problem with family medicine, but we think this will have a substantial impact on the profile and the view that our students get of family medicine from earlier in their careers. Now, let me turn now to the problem of defining the limits of what we teach, or to state it in another way, what does every doctor need to know? And this expands more largely into conversations I've had with many people, some in the room, about science teaching in our curriculum. And there's a lot of issues that come up. An important one, the one hears over and over again, is the problem of information overload. I have a number of wonderful descriptions of medical students describing their experience in first year. Somebody told me once, it's like drinking from a fire hose. I like that. Or alternatively, it's like eating nonstop. And I think that captures it very nicely. A second problem that one hears again from our students is, it's the science is good, but I don't want to be a scientist. I want to be a doctor. How do I take the science and apply it to the patients I deal with? And the people who are non-physicians who teach scientific topics are well aware of this and search hard for applications, relevance of what they've taught. And it's hard often to find convincing examples. So a sort of authentic application of the real science is not so easy to come by. There's a concern about the role that science teaching has in promoting scholarship and critical inquiry. And there's a pervasive concern about a need to promote the idea of the clinician scientist. And these are all legitimate issues, and I don't have the answers to all of them, but don't think I'm not thinking about them and people on my committee as well. So let me just look a little bit at some of these. So what should every doctor know? Very difficult question to know. It depends what that doctor is going to do. Well, true, but at some point there must be some basic information that we want David Eidelman to know, we want Jim Martin to know, we want Gordon Goldstein to know, we want Rob Primavesi to know. Hopefully they all know which side of the body the heart is in. Do they know the detailed innervation of the hand? Not sure. Do they need to know that? Well, maybe Rob does. I'm not sure that David does. Do I need to know that? Absolutely. But this is the problem. So how do we get at this? Well, Henry Mandon, who is a nephrologist in the University of Calgary a number of years ago, said more or less what I've put on the screen there. There must surely be a finite list of reasons that people go to the doctor. If one could write this list down, that would give us some sort of framework of what the limits of medical knowledge for a physician ought to be. And so he set about doing this, colleagues in Calgary, he consulted with many people across the country, and developed what he called a list of clinical presentations, the reasons people go to the doctor. And it turns out to be a list of 120-odd items. And it has I have always thought, an intrinsic common sense. And many people think likewise, and particularly the Medical Council of Canada for some years now has decided, yes, this is a reasonable way to delineate the boundary of medical knowledge, and we will use this as the basis of our qualifying exams that graduates of medical schools in Canada must pass in order to practice medicine. So the Medical Council of Canada clinical presentations then attempt to capture all the reasons patients visit doctors. And if you actually sit down and look at this list, anybody's interested, I invite you to do so. You can go to the MCC website and see it. It's really pretty good. It's really hard to come up with something that would be a reason somebody would go to the doctor that isn't on that list. It's not perfect, nothing is, but it's really, really quite impressive. And so we think that the goal of undergraduate medical education should be to equip our graduates to be able to deal with these clinical presentations. This is what we think our graduates should be able to do. And thereby, they provide some kind of a framework to help us decide what to include or what to exclude from the undergraduate curriculum. Right now, some of that sort of thinking goes on, but very often it's, so-and-so is an expert on this, and he or she thinks it's important, and he or she thinks that it needs 4 hours, and that's why it's there. And if you go through the basis of medicine, that's often the case. Probably a better way to think about this, the most succinct way that I know, is to borrow what I like to call, I'll come back to that in a second. Sorry, let me give you an example of what this might play out like in real life. So in Unit 6, which is the nervous system and special senses part of the basis of medicine, which I've been running for a number of years, one of the many topics we deal with is eye movements. Now, eye movements is a vast, it's a fascinating bit of neuroanatomy and neurophysiology, and we happen to have considerable local expertise, like in many topics in medicine. And so for many years, the expert delivered what I thought was an absolute tour de force, one-hour treatise on the subject of eye movements, which he summarized in a wonderfully succinct, single-spaced 20 pages of notes. So the unit chair and two or three students in the class thought this was fantastic, and the rest of the class just didn't know what was going on. If one looked at eye movements from the viewpoint of clinical presentations, you would come up with something quite different. If you go through the clinical presentations, you'll see that in 126 or so, there are really only three that have any relevance to eye movements: dizziness, coma, and diplopia. And so if one says, okay, now, yeah, eye movements is vast and fascinating, but this is the stuff that a medical graduate needs to be able to know about, then you come up with a very different way to present the subject of eye movements. And it's less detailed in some sense, but the thing that is much more difficult is you have to select, distill this large field into something that's very much more focused and directed. I can come up, that's an example I know well, but one could come up with many other examples on the basis of medicine. Peter McLeod, who's in the back of the audience, is fond of helping us with this by thinking about, is information we're presenting something that people must know, should know, or is just nice to know? And there's a lot of nice to know in what we do. There's nothing wrong with nice to know, but if time is limited, you've got to stick with the must know and the should know. So those are some of the hypothetical considerations. What will fundamentals of medicine dentistry actually look like? Well, superficially, the block diagram, and just to orient you here, this is the fall of first year, this is the spring of first year, this is summer, and this is the fall of second year. We will follow the same organ system-based arrangement, which everybody agrees is sensible and logical. Probably the two biggest changes here are the first block, the introductory block, which is presently really a crash course in cell biology. We want to very much expand the horizons of what medicine is about, because medicine is not just about cell biology, obviously. And the second major change is those of you teaching the basis of medicine now will know that more or less in first year we do the normal, and then in the fall of second year we do the abnormal. And what we're proposing to do instead is to consider normal and abnormal with each organ system. The hope with this is this will help students see much more clearly and immediately why what they heard about the action potential yesterday actually is applicable in patients. It won't be a gap of a year like there is now. Parenthetically, David Goldsmith, who was in charge of the designing of BOM in 1994, tells me that that was actually the original plan for BOM, but I think everybody ran out of energy, so it didn't happen. So, introduction, a much broader view of medicine. Number two, teach abnormal and normal side by side. And number three, what's not shown on this diagram, when students are in their longitudinal family medicine program placements, the family medicine tutors are going to be very much aware of what's actually happening in the classroom and going to be asked to make explicit connections between that and what they see in their family medicine practice. That's going to be a challenge, but if I've learned nothing else in the last year and a half, Lenny Lala is a highly effective person, and she will make sure that happens. Now, each of these blocks, I'm trying to change the terminology and stop calling them units, so we're calling them blocks. Each of these blocks will have a leader, analogous to the unit chairs, and we've now finally actually got all of the block leaders in place. These are the individuals. Some of these people are currently involved in the basis of medicine as unit chairs, and so I've deliberately kept some old hands. and some are people who've been involved in basis of medicine, not as leaders, and others who are relatively new to undergraduate teaching of this kind. Some of these are McGill grads who went through BOM. Others are people who have come from other schools who don't know what all the problems are. And I'm hoping this will be a congenial mixture of people. I'll just conclude by saying that one of the pleasures of doing this kind of job, one meets all kinds of people that one didn't know before. And I get discouraged about the magnitude of this business at times. But when I meet with the individuals, it's hard not to come away feeling rather inspired. And so I find myself often feeling like Miranda. Oh, wonder how many goodly creatures are there here, how beauteous mankind is, O brave new world that hath such people in it. And so I hope that you will all think of this, that about the curriculum in a couple of years. I'm happy to entertain questions. David. I mean, a lot of conversation that can certainly, I mean, yes, people are very much aware of that. It's interesting, sort of parenthetically to this, we've been asked to look at the admissions requirements to medicine recently, and they haven't changed since Osler's day, I don't think. And I think that there is likely to be some attempt to change what the pre-medicine requirements are. Some of my colleagues are actually proposing to construct a sort of a list of scientific topics that would be shown to would-be entrants to our medical school, saying, if you don't know about such and such, you better find out about it because we expect you're going to know it. Yes, yeah. Sure. No, and that was one of many things I haven't touched on. There's a number of ways, but the essential idea is that we're trying to, instead of having physicianship occur on Wednesday afternoons like it does now, sort of in its own universe, to have the topics within physicianship integrated specifically into the blocks for which they're relevant. So to give an example, this isn't explicitly physicianship as such. Aboriginal health, which is a sort of an idea that appears here and there in the current curriculum, usually sort of dropped in out of nowhere. We've asked the people involved with Aboriginal health to look at this organ system-based scheme, say, so where in this would it be particularly relevant? So, for example, the problem of diabetes in Kanawaki. Well, that should be in the block where we're talking about diabetes, because that's an explicit, specific example of this larger global issue. So we're trying to do that kind of thing. Jim. Right. Well, I don't. First of all, I'm not saying that we're saying our doctors should know less rather than more. They should know different, I think, is perhaps a fair way to say it. And in terms of recalibration, very much the message is not going to be, you once had 4 hours to teach us about gas exchange. Now you've got 1 hour. The question is going to the thing is going to be, now gas exchange is clearly important for a physician to understand in dealing with dyspnea and heart failure. keep that in the forefront and tell us what we need to do, a gas exchange to understand those things. It's sort of going at it in the backward direction. Yep. Well, postgrad I can't comment on, but within the undergraduate curriculum as it is now, there are places where there is provision for that kind of thing. Perhaps the best example is the anatomy for surgeons course that's taught in fourth year. So those who finally at the end of their medical school have realized they're going to be a surgeon or they're going to be a radiologist, they actually really need to know that anatomy that they supposedly learned in a year and a half ago, have a chance to go back and do it. You're right, the people who want to become ENT surgeons are going to have to go back and see, well, I saw the broad strokes of anatomy of the head and neck. Now I need to fill in some detail. But what we're doing right now, and again, I refer to Unit 6, which I know particularly well, is we're teaching the anatomy at a level that I show to an ENT surgeon. They say, that's ridiculous. What are you teaching all that stuff for? So we've gone so far on that. It's not everywhere in Baum, but it's pervasive.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Colin, for that excellent presentation. I'm going to move on. I would just point out to Jim that after years of teaching the first year physiology, I've yet to find a student who remembers anything that I taught them. So, we have to go to a different presentation, I guess. Is this one right? So, budget planning. Okay, you're going to hit F5 for me? So I'd like to introduce Pascale Morin, who is I think her title is senior director, but basically she's taken over running the administration of the faculty. And one of the thankless tasks that I've asked her to undertake is to implement a proper budgeting process. So many people in the room will have tried to come to me and ask what to do about their budget. So I will tell you what I told the accreditors from various accrediting agencies, that our budgeting process in the faculty is not functional. And so budgets that exist now are almost arbitrary. And therefore, we have some place people with more budget than they need and lots of people with less budget than they need. And even when we don't have the budget, we don't even know why. So Pascale has been tasked with that, but she's going to talk about where we are now. And as soon as it looks like I broke the PowerPoint machine, so it doesn't work anymore. Oh, there we go. She's going to talk about the fact that the faculty is not alone. In fact, there's a McGill-wide effort to improve our budgeting process. Pascale. Well, we don't know, so we just hold it.
Shop. Can you hear me well? Yes? Hello? I'm one of the things that the dean added to his team recently. Please bear with me. I was born francophone, so there is some accent and there are words that I look for at times. So not only am I going to talk to you about numbers and budgets, but all that with accent and hesitation maybe. So my story starts with McGill having done something that McGill liked to call a budget in the past years, and being told a few times already by consulting firms that what McGill considered a budget was not necessarily one, or was not one that responded, corresponded to standards in that milieu, in the practice. So this summer, for a third time, a consulting firm said in a very direct fashion to McGill, the way you've been doing things, putting together, first of all, an operational budget coming from the Ministry of Education, adding to that an envelope called the compact with specific projects, and adding to that again the priority pool, and adding to that again during the year some special allocation coming again from the Ministère de l'Éducation. Well, all that is not really the standard way and the logical way to do things. A budget should be constructed so that on the first day of your fiscal year, you know exactly how much you're going to get in terms of revenues, and you know how much you're going to be spending, including everything you had in mind for the next coming, for the coming months, for the next 12 months. So this summer, the central administration decided to undertake this new budget process and decided to go ahead with some basic principles that will look like this. The central administration now wants to build a budget, and it will do it for the first time for the 2013-14 fiscal year. So a budget based on these principles, the new principles. So first of all, the university says we have to start our budget thinking based on our mission, secondly, on our strategic priorities, and thirdly, on our objectives. I'll come back to that in a few minutes. We have to do a budget not only for the coming months, for the next year, but we should look forward and try to plan for 5 years. That would be a lot more logical. And this would result in, for example, plan for expenses to meet the university objectives or your objectives in your departments. If there is not enough money 1 year to use that money for that objective, then you will be allowed. This will allow you to say, well, then I'll postpone that expense to the next year. But at least you will know that it's booked, that it's reserved, and that you have a chance of getting that money for your project because it will correspond to the objective, even if it's not in the coming year. So it's going to be a 5-year exercise moving forward. Another principle that is, from what I understand, a big change is that it will involve multi-fund planning. You know, from what I hear has been done up to now, the budget was only prepared for the operating fund using the money coming from the Ministère de l'Éducation. From now on, we will want to integrate all sources of income, including the ones coming from the different endowment funds that have not necessarily been used or used efficiently. So this will be, I think, a change in culture to integrate all the funds that you may want to use or may be allowed to use and integrate the annual income. We found out that there's a lot of money that does not get spent during the year, although there are needs that are not met. So this is certainly going to be an improvement. The university also wants to link the whole exercise with performance indicators. I'll show you in the tables that were prepared what that will give. There is also a major issue with accountability in the sense that the university wants everyone planning for expenses, planning for revenues, planning for a budget for a team to be responsible for those numbers and to be linked to the results at the end of the year. I don't know if you saw, some of you have requested the opening of funds recently, and I've seen through the accounting finance department that there's a new system by which already the central administration is asking to link the opening of a fund with a backup guarantee in case there are cost overruns with that fund. I don't know if you know this, but as department heads, some of you have already signed to say that they would become responsible for cost overruns if by opening this fund there are more expenses than revenues getting into the fund. So this is already the start of this new culture to remind people that they are responsible for the money that they commit to use in one way or another. The central administration also wants to draft agreements between the administration and the faculties to make sure that everyone understands what the faculty is going to be doing to meet the objectives, what kind of money is involved, and how the performance indicators at the end of the year are going to reflect those results. So this is what it will look like, integrating what I just told you. So strategic priorities are listed in the gray area. The four priorities are there and are carried forward on each of these pages. So, for example, using the first priority to advance McGill's academic and research excellence as one of the world's leading publicly funded research-intensive universities. Let's take, for example, 1.4 as one of the objectives that were, the objectives were already defined earlier. So 1.4, we want to lead in research intensity and impact across Canada. So how is that going to be measured? By calculating the research revenue per full-time professor and by looking at the top standing within Canada in research prices and awards. The building of this new system is, as you see, linked between objective and performance measures. And we were told that, of course, there are going to be rewards for those who will respect the objectives and will measure well, and we will be punished for not attaining the measures that are requested from us. Well, maybe I'll come back. See, the second priority is that the university wants to achieve a sustained focus on student-centeredness by enhancing educational research and extracurricular life and learning experiences. So, for example, 2.3, provide diverse international experiences to students. How are we going to measure that with the percentage of international students, percentage of students abroad? Another example, linked to the third priority, raise further McGill's external visibility, success, and reputation. So let's take 3.3 as an example. The objective is to increase alumni engagement in targeted areas. It's going to be measured by the number of alumni volunteers, hours volunteered, alumni event attendance, alumni donations, and participation and intensity. The fourth one is effectively manage financial, capital, and human resources on a multi-year basis. So, for example, 4.3, the objective is to manage existing capital assets to support academic and research priorities. It's going to be measured by looking at deferred maintenance, facilities conditions index. In medicine, maybe we should ask them to add a mold index, considering the state of our buildings. That could be one suggestion. But you see the relationship that they want to do. In terms of timeline, this is starting now, and the objective is to have a new budget for the end of April, so we start on May 1st with this fresh, newly prepared budget. We understand from the comments we get centrally that, of course, it's going to be a transition, so I don't think the central administration is expecting too much from the, well, it's not going to be too strict at applying the new rules and the new ways to go. Everyone understands that it's a big cultural change, and it will start and go, we will go from there. So the link with the faculty now, some of you know that we were anyway intending to start a zero-based budget exercise for the next year, 13-14. So this falls into place very well in the sense that we are going to start visits, meetings with department heads next week. We targeted five departments whom we would like to start the exercise with. And this is really good timing, because what we were going to start, even though the words are not the same and the structure is not theoretically the same, the ideas are the same. Thinking ahead properly, taking into account everything we need to do, and match that with an envelope that's going to be rational and logical based on the objectives and the needs of each department. So we are in agreement with all this and hope that you will be, because it's certainly good news for all of us at McGill. I think we need to conform to this era of governance and well-structured finances and considering the financial constraints at the provincial level, it's going to be the right thing to do to be well organized in terms of finances. Thank you. So that's my short presentation. Yes, Dr. Rosenblatt, you're thinking of the departure of employees, among other things, who are not...
There's more and more requests for documentation, so that everything at a time of administrative support across the board is decreasing, and by government decree to the universities.
Well, the university wants to make sure that efficiency is au rendezvous, you know, that the human resources we have work efficiently and with great productivity. So I think that's one reasonable expectation. The 1-4-2 rule, as you know, we're working hard to convince the central administration that it might not be appropriate to apply it in all cases. And we have many cases in the Faculty of Medicine where things have been stretched so much that the idea of losing an employee and replacing the employee with only 50% of the budget simply doesn't make sense. So we're working hard at convincing the central administration that there has to be exceptions made to that principle, and it simply cannot be applied at large.
So the answer is we don't know yet. I mean, I think that though it does speak to the next presentation, it's an excellent segue. Thank you very much, Pascal. I want to ask Andrew and Christine to come and talk about changes to some experiments we're doing and how to do administration more efficiently.
Thank you, Dr. Eidelman. So I'm Christine Dolden. I know most of you, but not everybody. As Dr. Eidelman explained, I work primarily for Dr. Mara Ludwig in the Academic Affairs Office, but I'm also a member of the Administration Excellence Project Team, along with my colleague here, Andrew Mackay. So we wanted to give you an update on the Administration Excellence Project. Just let the PowerPoint get in order first. So some of you have heard about the Administration Excellence Project. Others still haven't heard too much about it. But we're here today to let you know that we're very excited to announce that the pilot project got off the ground in the month of September. The two departments that we're starting with for the pilot project are the departments of neurology, neurosurgery, and psychiatry. And this is a new administrative model that we plan to unroll throughout the Faculty of Medicine. It's an administrative model that is based on a model that is used at the University of Minnesota. And what we are doing essentially is we are clustering the administrative support for two or more departments into an administrative center. For our pilot project, we're focusing on finance and human resources, HR for both academic and admin support staff. The goal of the project, of course, is to improve our current administrative structure, to make it more robust, to make it more flexible and responsive to the needs of the faculty. The administrative structure that we had until now worked fine for the 100 or so years for the Faculty of Medicine. But we felt it was no longer going to sustain us as we look to the future and what's happening to meet our needs and to meet our strategic plans for the faculty. So the long-term goal is that eventually we will unroll these administrative centers throughout the faculty. We're starting with this one, but we anticipate ultimately that there will be about 10 admin centers throughout the faculty. We're focusing just on HR and finance for the pilot project, but our long-term goal is to see how this model can also be applied to student affairs and pre-award research as well. Okay. Should I start with that? So this is the org chart for our first administrative center. We have Anna Maria Henderson, who's our first center director, or we call it the associate director. She's working with the two chairs, Dr. Israel and Dr. Fellows. And the initial team includes three finance positions. We have Melanie Pepin as the financial officer. And we have Wenwen Zhu as the accounts administrator. And we're currently recruiting for the finance administrator. On the HR side, we have Priya Bisson-Nuth. She's the HR advisor. And we have Manon Trudeau as the HR administrator. So this new team is currently they're located on the third floor at 3605. And one of the reasons why we wanted to have our training center close by is they're working closely with the various areas of the deanery for more intensive training in all of these areas. So we're very excited about this new team that's been put together, and they're very excited about their new role, and I think it's off to a great start. I'll let Andrew provide some more information on this project.
Right distance from the mic, is that okay? I'll start by saying I completely agree. We don't have enough family doctors out there because this week, my sore back, I couldn't find one. I waited 4 hours in a clinic just to see somebody I didn't even know. So I'm 100% behind that idea. Just to sort of catch you up on what's been going on, we've had a number of advancements in the last little while. First of all, as pointed out, since June, we've staffed almost everybody in the center. We are in second interviews. I believe it's second interviews for the finance position. Yes, I'm getting a nod, so I'm not too far off there. Oops, sorry. And so we have searched to find people who are, we started to use the word experts in the field, or in their fields. The idea here is that these centers are going to provide the type of services or the quality of service that you have up front. I know I've worked with some of the chairs. I'm looking at Dr. Rosenblatt here, who's suffering a situation himself in his area right now. But what we have found and what we have discovered over the years in the preparation for this, and I arrived at the end, so I'm the lucky one. I didn't have to do the groundwork. The people, your administrators right now are overburdened. They don't have the resources to be experts in finance, to be experts in HR, to be experts in all of the many things that are coming in. And yes, someone pointed out, might have been Dr. Rosenblatt, that there's more and more expected of you with less and less resources. The goal here is to ensure that you have the resources you need to be able to address these problems, and so that you can focus on your teaching, your research, and the other aspects of your other priorities, and let the administrators do the administration. At this point, we have an implementation team that is up and running. The implementation team is made up of reps from HR, finance, academic affairs, and IT. Yes, thank you. Their job is to assist with the implementation, obviously, but also to map out the processes that are going to take place in this learning curve that everyone is going through. And it's our hope that what we learn in this first initial center will create the guidebook for the next center, so which would make the rollout that much quicker and that much more efficient. At the same time, they're looking at our infrastructure and telling us about issues, bottlenecks, problems that we've identified, and we're going to address them for the whole faculty, not just the pilot project, but the whole faculty, particularly in the way we handle, access, and exploit data, which is essential for all of us. I'm going to turn my page here. we also need to know how are we going to measure this. It's one thing to say that, you know, subjectively we want to improve and have an excellent service, but we need to have a baseline. So in the months to come, you will receive a survey. Well, essentially the people in the first initial group will receive a survey on the satisfaction level they have for the service they're receiving today. And it's our hope, 6 months down the road, to relaunch this survey again to be able to measure effectively what has changed since the implementation of this process. We also need to plan ahead. One of the things that we've all identified quickly and easily since we've arrived at McGill, the newbies that is that we tend to be reactive. That's a word that I've been using a lot lately. We're not proactive. We're not thinking ahead. So what we'd like to do is we're going to contact all of the administrators in the Faculty of Medicine and ask them, going forward, what would you like to do in one of these centers? We are going to have 10 centers that we indicated. We're going to have 10 associate directors. We're going to have 20 HR specialists, 20 student affairs specialists, academic affairs and finance specialists. We're going to need to fill these spots, and we're going to fill them from people who are already here. So it's our intention to reach out now, find out who's interested, and start planning, working with these people, developing them for these centers down the road. So that, you know, a couple of months from now, 6 months from now, when we're ready to roll out the next couple of centers, we'll have identified the key people, they'll already be started their training, and they'll be able to step in. There are other services, and I think the dean has mentioned 2.0 a couple of times. Student affairs, other services may eventually join this process. For the moment, it's finance and HR. Any questions?
Okay, thank you very much. I think that what you can see is that both the university and the faculty are in the process of trying to reimagine how to do things. These are not simple tasks. We don't expect these kind of changes to have beneficial effects instantaneously. I hope you'll agree with me that at least we're making an attempt to organize things in a more logical way. I think David Rosenblatt's comment about the increasing bureaucratic demands on people is absolutely correct. And unfortunately, it's coming at a time of reduced resources, so we really have to think more cleverly. Unfortunately, we have a lot of clever people. So I'm going to quickly go through, before the wine and cheese. We've been very, very successful. I don't know how many people have been watching this on the news things. Every month, the FRQ has its star research trainees. And I have to say, McGill has at least one in every single batch, usually from the Faculty of Medicine. And so I'm not going to read out everybody's name. We've had a Rhodes Scholar and so on and so forth, a very long list of awardees for many prestigious awards. I'm sure this is some, this looks sort of like you, Claudio, in London getting a Brain of McGill. Claudio was there representing us, winning an prestigious award for collaboration with Britain. There you can see me earlier this week handing out the Bronfman Center Awards to a very distinguished Motley Crue. We have winners of the Queen Elizabeth II Diamond Jubilee Medal, the Engineering Science and Engineering Hall of Fame, and so on and so forth. I've had the opportunity to go to a few of these events, and I can tell you it's just spectacular. It's really exciting because it goes on. I'm obviously not going to read out every single name. Canadian Academy of Health Sciences, Royal College, Michel Sarrazin Award, and of course Paul Clark Principal's Prize for Excellence in Teaching. That's a very prestigious award, and so on. We also had a homecoming where I got to model the new bow tie of the faculty, but we also, it was a great event that I think many of you participated in. It's very exciting. It was, for me, very exciting because it was my first time to play the role of dean, and I don't know if you know, but one of the perks of being the dean, I don't know if this was true in your day, Dr. Proust, but you get the chauffeured around town from party to party. It's pretty cool. And so I think you can see by the list of awards and honorees and the number of changes that are going on in the faculty that we're really in a period of effervescence. I know reading the newspaper, you would conclude that we're in a bleak age of penury and pessimism, and it may be like that out there. But in here, we have a kind of a modest optimism that we're going to make a difference and things are going to keep getting better. We've got an amazing faculty of medicine, and I'm very proud to be leading it, and we're delighted to present this to you today. So thank you very much. I think I'm going to, unless there's pressing issues, I'm going to invite people to go and schmooze at the Wine and Cheese. Thanks a lot.